to play a primarily hip-hop format. He and his Wrecking Crew colleague, DJ Yella, created Drive Time traffic jam mixes, and Dre performed at high school noon dances for the station all over the metropolitan area. While school kids slurped milk and ate sandwiches, he played hip-hop, and maybe even some Parliament Funkadelic, working to get them up and out of their seats. He became a fixture at Eve After Dark, a teenage turntablist who knew what the crowd wanted, but wasn't always willing to play it. He pissed off local bloods by refusing to play the Barkay song, Freak Show on the Dance Floor, said Anthony Williams, a frequent Eve attendee. The bloods love pop-locking to that song, he said, but he wasn't going to let anyone tell him what to play. When I was coming up, to develop my skills, I had to do it the hard way, Dre said. It was basically on-the-job training. He just took everything. As Andre's professional possibilities expanded, his personal life became rocky. While Lisa Johnson was pregnant with their second daughter, he beat her twice, she claimed, in a restraining order application filed in California's Superior Court on May 7, 1985. The first time, when she was about 6 months pregnant, he knocked her back, causing my head to hit the wall, and striking her several times, reads her complaint, which also says he hit her again when she was about 8 months pregnant. Dr. Dre, through his attorney, had no comment on Johnson's allegations. If Dre filed documents denying claims made in the restraining order, they were not available. The birth of LaToya in September 1984 didn't smooth things over. A few days before Christmas that year, reads the restraining order, he hit me in the mouth and bust my lip at Johnson's mother's house. Then one day in April 1985, Andre came calling to her aunt's home in South Central, where she was then living. He had recently turned 20, and she was pregnant with their third daughter, Andre's fifth child. She said she didn't want to see him anymore because he was not helping to take care of our daughter. And he then knocked her down twice, states the document. If it hadn't been for my cousin Nessa, he was going to kick me while I was on the ground, it continues. Nessa told him to leave me alone. He jumped in his car and left and said, I'll be back again. Johnson's aunt, who asked me not to use her name to protect her anonymity, recalled this incident as well. He hit her upside the head. He was kicking her. He called her all kinds of names, she said. I jumped in. I grabbed him and knocked him off of her and threw him in the rose bush. Less than 2 weeks later, Andre came back, according to the document. He had a gun, tell me to come out, bitch, and saying that he would kill me because I didn't know who I was fucking with. Johnson's allegations against Andre were never ruled upon in court because she did not file criminal charges, but her aunt helped her apply for a combined child support order and domestic violence restraining order, and on May 29, 1985, Judge Lee B. Reagans ordered Andre to stay at least 100 yards away from Johnson and to pay $200 a month child support for each girl. He ignored both directives, Johnson claimed.
He didn't do any child support, and he did not stop contacting me, she said, adding that he did not contribute financially to the kid's upbringing until a court compelled him to do so in the 90s after he'd become a major star with NWA and as a solo artist. He messed up her whole life. She has not been the same since. She was a beautiful young lady, said Johnson's aunt. He just took everything that she had. I really did love him, Johnson said. He was somebody that I looked up to because he had a vision, and I saw him struggle with his art that he wanted to do, and I had faith in this guy. I believed everything he told me.
He struggled getting money for her, for the kids, but none of us had any money, said Mark Clientele Hawkins, the fourth member of World Class Wrecking Crew. There was a point where the music thing just didn't appear to be happening for us. In her memoir,
Andre's mother accuses Johnson of being, at times, an irresponsible mother and also of fabricating stories to get Andre to respond to her. Three other women would later accuse Andre of beating them, including a mother of one of his other children. Surgery. Music was Andre's shelter from the chaos overtaking his life. But though he loved hip-hop, it wasn't clear he could make a living doing it. The Los Angeles scene was still in its infancy, and it wasn't yet creating stars like the East Coast. "People back East didn't know much of what was going on in the West," said the Glove. "Back then, they used to call Los Angeles Southern." In 1983, Lonzo brought Run-DMC to Eve After Dark. Dr. Dre was inspired by the performance. But the New York group, clad in leather pants, weren't feeling the local Morris Day styles. "They looked at us like we was a bunch of faggots," said Lonzo. "Some people from the East Coast wouldn't respect nobody at the time," admitted African Bambaataa. He said he respected the West, however, and the feeling was mutual. The world-class Wrecking Crew borrowed pretty obviously from Planet Rock on their track, Planet. "We are the pilots of your shuttle, transporters of love," they intone, over outer space synth effects. The group's settled lineup featured four DJs, who could rap to varying degrees, though Lonzo was hindered by a lisp. Dre's emulation of LL Cool J earned him the nickname LL Cool Dre. Their songs tackled a wide variety of themes. Horny Computer piggybacked on the cyber-erotic fixation of the era, while Gang Bang You're Dead confronted the ascendant gang culture, their colors, their beverages, and their sartorial styles. "You wear red rags, blue rags, and big shoelaces. You drink 40-ounce brews by the cases. You dress so tacky till you look like a slob, and you wonder why you can't get a job." Clientele had the idea to do the song after a friend was killed by gang violence. It was co-written by Lonzo and Dre, and was one of the first songs Dre rapped on. Surgery, meanwhile, was his star turn. With breathy vocals, serious scratching, and a synth line beeping like a heart monitor, it features Andre in Lothario mode. "The nurses say I'm cute, they say I'm fine, so you better beware because I'll blow your mind." He was gradually coming out of his shell, growing comfortable on the mic. But he hated the crew's emasculating song, Lovers, modeled on LL Cool J's I Need Love. In it, the singer Mona Lisa shoots down each group member in succession. Still, it became hard to argue when it became their biggest early hit. "Dre and DJ Yella didn't want to do any slow records at first," Clientele said. "Me and Lonzo convinced them it would be a good thing. Once they saw the reaction from the girls going crazy, they were like, hell yeah." Form flattering. West Compton native Antoine Carabee's name became synonymous with his prowess on the turntables. Originally known as Brick Hard, at the suggestion of former crew member, the Unknown DJ, the light-skinned, introverted Carabee took his stage name from a 1981 new wave song called Yella. Obsessed with Prince, DJ Yella wore paisley designs and performed moves straight out of Purple Rain. Laid back, not one to rock the boat, he kept things light. Andre and Yella loved chasing women together, and the pair complimented each other well musically. After a Curtis Blow show, that rapper's DJ, Davey DMX, taught Yella to scratch, and Yella in turn taught Dr. Dre. This was a big deal. Not many people on the West Coast were yet scratching, and Dre proceeded to run with the style. Dre was faster on the turntables than Yella, Clientele said. Yella was more of a blender, and Dre did more of the scratching. The group's home base was Alonzo Williams' South Central home, where the guys recorded, hung out, and practiced their dance moves. "We would watch ourselves in the reflection of the window and look at ourselves rehearse," Lonzo told me in July 2014. We spoke from his studio, an unattached bungalow behind that same house, where he still lives today, formerly owned by famed bandleader Johnny Otis. Lonzo had big plans for the group, beginning with the release of their 1985 debut, World Class, on his own label, called Crew Cut. He also crafted their image. They shot the album's cover in a makeshift studio at the Hollywood offices of McCullough Records, which pressed up the work. Andre's mother, Verna, and one of Lonzo's buddies, a tailor, helped create their custom duds. For the shoot, Lonzo donned a black sequin jacket and earrings shaped like stars, while Clientele wore a purple satin tuxedo jacket with black sequined lapels and a white dress shirt unbuttoned nearly to his navel. Yella had a similar purple jacket with shoulder pads as well as white gloves. Dr. Dre's white, form-flattering sequined surgical-themed outfit was fashioned from a medical supply store smock. A stethoscope hung around his neck. Makeup was a must for any self-respecting song and dance group of the era, to say nothing of the hair metal bands up on the Sunset Strip. World-class Wrecking Crew had no professional makeup artist, so those duties fell to the act's manager, Shirley Dixon. She powdered their faces to cut the glare and greased their lips to make them shiny. Dre was painted with blush, and finally, for an extra touch, he and DJ Yella got a smidge of eyeliner. This was the Prince influence again. The purple one had drastically changed the idea of masculinity in pop music. Besides, even acts like Dre's idols Parliament Funkadelic wore colorful duds and engaged in wild theatrics. "This was the 80s," defended Lonzo. "You wore a little bit of makeup." The crew looked in the mirror, got the okay from Shirley, and were ready to go. They posed for photos, bathed in purple light, the smoke machine working double time. Some shots were smoldering, some weren't. Dr. Dre, feeling goofy, clowned around in silly positions. He had no idea these pictures would come back to haunt him. "I'll tell you what, I never had no motherfucking lace on. That was Yella," Dr. Dre later grumbled. Dre's production skills accelerated rapidly. He and Clientele camped out in the studio for days at a time, enlisting others to bring them food or clean clothes. The crew's first show was opening for New Edition at Fremont High School, and they began attracting bigger crowds for their live performances, featuring sweaty dance floor numbers and sexy slow jams. When Eve After Dark closed in 1985, Lonzo began hosting parties at a Compton spot called Dudo's. The crew played there as well as the adjacent skating ring, Skateland. Lonzo rocked the keytar. Moore's Day in the Time song, The Bird, inspired one of the crew's synchronized dance routines, complete with slide steps, hip swivels, and bird-like arm flapping. Decked out in doctor suits of powder blue or purple satin, Dre had fun with it, and crowds dug their energy. "We was appealing to the women back then," said DJ Yella. With Lonzo steering the ship, the glammed-up smooth operators began performing shows around the country, sharing stages with sexified funk and R&B-leaning acts including the Bar K's, Orange Juice Jones, and Rick James' Mary Jane Girls. They graduated from headlining skating rinks to playing an early hip-hop event called Fresh Fest at the 12,000-capacity Wembley Arena in London. In 1986, they won a record deal with CBS, complete with a $100,000 advance. Problems quickly emerged. Clientele said he looked into the group's financial records and saw irregularities. It was enough to convince him to leave the crew before their next album, Wrapped in Romance, released on the CBS subsidiary Epic. Lonzo admitted he took the greatest share of their $100,000 advance. The others couldn't help but notice his new house and BMW, but insisted it was because he was the investor and label owner, and more sensibly managed his earnings. When Wrapped in Romance tanked in 1986, they were dropped by CBS. Things looked bleak. Though their independently released 1987 song, Turn Off the Lights, became their biggest hit, The group was already broken up by the time it got popular. Dr. Dre had had enough. It wasn't just about the money. He tired of the group's frou-frou image and believed their glossy, pandering ballads were out of touch. He wanted to make hard-edged music like Run-DMC, or maybe like Ice-T's new song, Six in the Morning. But Lonzo wasn't interested. Ballads were their bread and butter. "They wouldn't do my songs," Dre said. "They said they'd never get on the radio." Dre knew better. Run-DMC slayed at Eve After Dark. Though they only played for about 10 minutes, the show affected him profoundly. Their hard-edged rhymes and powerful beats showed him that kick-ass hip-hop could thrill a crowd, and he was certain that he could do that. The California Shake. Around 1986, Eric Wright and a drug-dealing associate fell into a dispute. One of Eric's Volkswagen Bugs was burned to a crisp, right in his parents' driveway, so Eric had the guy's own car burned in response. No one remembers why they were beefing. "It was over either money or girls," said his partner Mark Rucker. But things were getting out of hand. Even Eric's own crew couldn't be trusted. His runner, JD, was dipping into the supply to get high himself. He even stole Eric's radio right out of his car. Eric grew frustrated. The stash from his gunned-down cousin Horace Butler had run out, and Eric now had to purchase his drugs from other suppliers like anyone else. What once seemed like easy money had become stressful. Others were now gunning for him, hoping to take his spot. "There was always threats on Eric's life," said his friend Big A. Few knew Eric had another passion in life, which he hoped could get him out of the drug game permanently. Hip-hop. With his friend MC Ren, he'd go shopping for records at the Rhodium Swap Meet. Held on the sprawling Torrance grounds of a former drive-in movie theater, the swap meet featured booths as far as the eye could see, selling everything from laundry detergent to airbrushed T-shirts. Eric and Ren frequented the stall run by Steve Yano, a Japanese-American one-time psychology grad student who dropped out to sell music. In earlier days, he and his wife Susan had thrown disco parties at their house, but their rhodium shop was now frequented by kids looking for the latest jams. Optimally located directly across from the snack bar, the Yanos hung covers like Michael Jackson's Thriller from their awning and played hot cassettes to entice kids. While closing up shop at night, they'd set their pegboards on the ground, and kids sometimes breakdanced or pop-locked right on top of them. Eric didn't know it then, but some of the tapes the Yanos played were made by Andre Young. Eric had known Dre casually from the neighborhood, but had no idea about his prowess on the turntables, about how he compiled the hottest rap hits of the day on TDK's 60-minute cassettes, adding in his signature scratches. You might hear the Fat Boys, King T, or Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. In exchange, the Yanos gave Andre records full of breakbeats, the drum patterns that he could sample in his own songs. He would tell Steve, "This is gonna be a hit. You gotta push these records," Susan Yano said. And he was always right. Eventually, the Yanos began selling these tapes with names like 86 in the Mix for $10 or so, and they became hot sellers themselves. Sure, it wasn't really legal to hawk music they didn't own the rights to, but how else was it going to get out there? Most hip-hop came from New York, and almost nobody else local was selling it. The tapes became so popular that rappers begged to be on them, and Dre began recording artists like Tone Loc and Young MC. Dre also put his own songs on the tapes, which particularly impressed Eric. "What is this?" he asked one day, upon hearing a new track. As Steve Yano explained, Eric finally understood. This was his neighbor's music. He promptly bought up all of Dre's music that Yano had on offer, pulling a bundle of bills out of his sock. "Tell Andre I want to get together," Eric said, and asked for Dre's number. Yano eventually agreed to set up a meeting over the phone. Next thing I know, Yano said, those guys are on a three-way call with me at 2 in the morning. Eric wants to open a record store. I tell him, don't do it. It's a bad business. I can show you how, but don't do it. Instead, Yano suggested they should start a record label. Eric brooded on the idea. In the meantime, Dre needed a new benefactor. He wanted to make songs that were harder and more visceral, but needed money to record in the studio. He knew two people who might be willing to help him. One was a local drug dealer named Laylaw Goodman, who worked with him on some early songs, including a spooky Halloween-themed 1985 track called Monster Rapping, which was produced by Dre and Lonzo, and rapped by Laylaw in his spookiest Bela Lugosi Dracula voice. The other was Eric. And so he set about convincing him. The High-Powered Crew. After Lonzo upgraded to a BMW, he gave Dr. Dre his old Mazda RX-7. It was a flashy car, and Dre racked up a series of moving violations, which led to a warrant being put out for his arrest and him being sent to jail. When Eric found out about the situation, he called up Lonzo. Dre's in jail, he said. Give me some money to get him out. Lonzo had been willing to spring Dre from jail before, but on this occasion, he was short on funds and decided to pay his BMW note instead, giving Dre a chance to stew on his own recklessness in the process. Eric decided to bail Dre out himself, and their bond grew. Dre convinced Eric to invest some of his profits into a music venture. Dre and Eric, both now in their early 20s, began recording tapes in a makeshift studio in the latter's garage, mixing popular instrumental tracks in their own creations. Their collaborators included DJ Pooh, later famous for co-writing the 1995 film Friday. We didn't want to just make mixtapes. We wanted to make the music that wound up on the mixtapes, DJ Pooh said. Eric's mother kept them lubricated with Kool-Aid. Dre and Eric began playing house parties, pool parties, and proms together as a mobile DJ team called High-Powered Crew. We came up with the name because we used to keep money in our pockets, said another member, Horace Mr. Sheen Taylor, Eric's cousin. Showcasing rappers and playing songs like Run-DMC's My Adidas, they performed all over South L.A., from Downey to Lakewood, piloting Eric's old beat-up Ford truck to gigs, which they called the California Shake because it wobbled when it went over 35 miles per hour. Dre was clearly the star, while Eric, who could DJ a little bit himself, was the operations financier. He bought the necessary equipment and divvied up the couple $100 they might receive per event. Not everybody knew what to make of this pairing, the hardened street cat and the flamboyant entertainer. I thought he was gay because he wore two earrings, said Mark Rucker of Dr. Dre. Eric said, he's cool. We're going to do this music thing. Eric took stock. All things considered, he was pretty lucky. Unlike so many others who slanged, he was still alive and not in prison. Horace Butler's fate weighed heavily on him.
I seen that it wasn't really worth it. It wasn't worth my life, Eric said. I figured I could do something right for a change instead of something wrong.
But he wasn't about to be under someone else's thumb. Like in his drug business, Eric preferred to operate independently.
I figure if I work for my damn self, I could lay my own fucking rules, he said.
Dre again brought up the idea of the two of them starting a record label together. Eric liked the idea, but his dealing partner looked at him like he was crazy.
What you know about music? Rucker asked.
It was a good point. Eric certainly didn't know how to rap. But the skeptical look on his friend's face turned to gratitude when Eric handed him several ounces of crack. They were his to sell gratis. Eric was done with all that. It was settled. Eric and Dr. Dre would make a real go of this thing. Still, the picture wasn't yet complete. For that, they'd need to combine forces with a cocksure South Central kid, one who still rode the school bus every day. Chapter 3. We'll Pull Your Card. O'Shea Jackson's grueling daily school bus ride took an hour or more in the morning, and then another hour in the afternoon. Departing from his family's tidy one-story mid-century house on Van Wyck Street, he'd finally arrive at high school in the San Fernando Valley. When he got home, he'd head down the block to his friend Sir Jinx's place. O'Shea knew things were on and cracking if the derelict garage door was held up by a broom. Outside, there was a gang war. But inside, the garage was a veritable hip-hop paradise. Sir Jinx, an aspiring young producer in oversized glasses whose real name was Tony Wheaton, had turntables, a DJ booth, and a cassette player hooked up to the speakers. In Woodshop, he'd even made a coffin-shaped box to house his mixing board and record players. Neighborhood turntablists battled. Breakdancers twisted on checkerboard linoleum. Aspiring producers made beats on Sir Jinx's drum machine, although it wasn't very sophisticated, not surprising considering he'd procured it from a drug dealer friend who received it as payment from a crackhead. O'Shea and Sir Jinx lived in an unincorporated part of L.A. County, sandwiched between South Central and Inglewood. In the mid-80s, there were setups like Sir Jinx's garage all over South Los Angeles. From a parent's perspective, hip-hop garages were perfect, close enough to keep an eye on their kids, removed enough so they could sleep at night. An up-and-coming DJ named Battlecat operated out of a garage in western South Central. Just blocks from O'Shea's house, his future West Side Connection colleague, Dub C, and Dub C's brother, DJ Crazy Tunes, hosted kids in their own garage. On nearby Haas Avenue, in DJ Fat Jack's garage, aspiring turntablists with names like DJ Slip and Rockin' Tom took their parents' disco records and harvested loops for future tracks. O'Shea was obsessed with the genre. Its breakout hit, The Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight, mesmerized him as a prepubescent in 1979. What you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the bead. Later, in his Parkman Middle School typing class in ninth grade, O'Shea discussed hip-hop with a classmate named Terry Kiddo Hayward.
Have you ever tried to write a rap?
Kiddo asked him. O'Shea shook his head.
Let's try to write one, Kiddo said. You write one, and I'll write one, and we'll see which one comes out the best.
O'Shea thought for a minute, and finally came up with,
My name is Ice Cube, and I want you to know I'm not Run DMC or Curtis Blow.
It was the first original line he ever rapped. His moniker was bestowed by his brother Clyde, a mercurial protective sibling 9 years older. Clyde chastised his little brother for trying to talk to his girlfriends when they called.
He got mad at that. He said he was going to slam me in the freezer one day, turn me into an ice cube,
O'Shea said in a 2016 interview with Wired.
I said, you know what? That's a badge of honor.
But O'Shea wasn't exactly suave when it came to rapping. Sir Jinx's garage became his training ground. In a variation on the cypher freestyle circles popular in New York, where MCs stood in a circle and rhymed off the top of their heads, one after another, they practiced performing rhymes and measures, rapping 4 8-bars at a time. When one guy finished, he passed the mic to the next guy. The trick was smooth transition. Those who couldn't keep the beat ate crow. Graffiti art lined the garage walls. The boys' attempt to replicate the 1984 New York hip-hop movie, Beat Street. O'Shea and his friends were obsessed with New York acts like the Beastie Boys, Slick Rick, and Run DMC, even borrowing their big glasses and Kango hats to go with their Adidas pullovers, troop jackets, and gold chains. The spot was a blast, free of drugs, alcohol, and gangland foolishness. O'Shea himself admonished those who smoked weed. So what if it smelled like poop? Jinx's beloved dog, Princess, had the run of the place.
and the guys found themselves hot-stepping over dog shit. It may have been low rent, but a bubbling cauldron of talent passed under that janky garage door, including Candyman, known for his 1990 Billboard top hit, Knockin' Boots. For his part, O'Shea was quickly developing the skills that would make him into Ice Cube, a master MC who could tear a verse apart and put it back together.
"It was in his soul,"
said his friend, clientele from World Class Wrecking Crew. "There was no snarl back then. That came later. But it was his drive. It was his willingness to do whatever to be better."
"He was really good at storytelling," said Doug Young, NWA's promoter. "He had subjects. He had predicates. When you listen to Cube rap, you see the story in your head. He paints the picture."
Though Ice Cube spent hours in Sir Jinx's garage, the inspiration for his raps would increasingly come from the volatile world outside those four walls. The words South Central strike fear in some hearts, but making generalizations about the 50-square-mile section of Los Angeles is difficult, considering the diversity of its people and landscape. The northwestern section includes the historic West Adams neighborhood and the posh Baldwin Hills, also known as the Black Beverly Hills. Central Avenue boasted a world-class jazz scene in the first part of the 20th century, while Leimert Park is home to Afrocentric stores and creative nonprofits. It's also the former home base for the Good Life Cafe, whose project, Blowed, Open Mic Night, fostered conscious yet still badass groups like Freestyle Fellowship and Jurassic 5. Housing projects abut colorful squat residences, while rows of rundown blocks are interrupted by houses with fantastically detailed trim and bars on the windows. There are stately churches and sprawling parks, and you'll find lemon and palm trees, some of the latter as big as water towers, sprouting in front yards. There are Latin mini-markets, barbecue spots, Korean liquor stores, and Mexican-run burger stands. Rusted cars sit permanently on lawns. You can shop at swap meets, independently owned beauty supply stores, moped shops, or out of people's garages. Like any poor community, there's a strong second-hand economy. Realtors working north of Interstate 10 obsessively rename neighborhoods to make them sound appealing. The Los Angeles area I lived in for a time was known alternately as Mid-City, Miracle Mile, Mid-Wilshire, and even Pickfair Village. But Ice Cube's area was broken down by gang turf, not nicknames. The block of Van Wyck Street where he grew up was controlled by the 111 neighborhood Crips, so named for West 111th Street, two blocks to the south. The gang is also known as In Hood. But if you jogged farther south past Imperial Highway, you were into 115 neighborhood Crips territory. Other Crips subsets were nearby, each carving up areas of maybe 10 square blocks or more. Gangbangers would come right up to you and ask where you were from, and if they didn't like the answer, they'd pound you. You didn't have to be a Crip to get your ass kicked for living in a Crip neighborhood. Which is why kids from Cube's block didn't often cross nearby South Van Ness Avenue into Blood's territory. Even young kids couldn't claim ignorance for long. As a second grader, Sir Jinx remembered plopping down on the bus one day when a girl asked him his set.
"Set?" he said. "What's that?"
He found out soon enough. Still populated by many gainfully employed residents, Cube and Jinx's street, where on a clear day you could see the Hollywood sign, wasn't so bad, at least comparatively. Dane Webb, the former Rap Pages editor, described it as a gang-infested neighborhood, but more upper-crust blue-collar, though not pinky-out upper-crust.
"This looked like a nice neighborhood, but when it get dark, that's when you hear the gunshots," Cube said.
He added that during his childhood, his own home was shot up.
"There were shells that the police had to pick up right in the grass."
Juice. Cube was a short, well-built, natural athlete,
a standout in both basketball and football. He and his friends played sideline rack-em-up football in the street, pitting their section of Van Wyck against other local blocks. Two-hand touch, though players could knock you out of bounds onto the grass behind the curbs, or even into cars. Cube played in the local Pop Warner League as well, serving as outside linebacker and fullback. His brother Clyde had another nickname for him, Juice, because his initials, O.J., were the same as retired NFL star O.J. Simpson. The youngest of four, O'Shea grew up in a close-knit family, and when he came of age, his parents bought him a Volkswagen Bug, the trendy car at the time. His parents worked at UCLA, his mother Doris as a custodian, and his father Jose, a groundskeeper. Squat, no-nonsense Jose had a garage full of tools and maintenance equipment and cut the grass for many in the neighborhood. Jose taught Cube to be a leader, he said, while Clyde convinced him gangs were a waste of time. My brother had been through all that shit, so he was like, man, you don't have to do that, Cube told Bomb Magazine in 1993. It's a trip because I look at motherfuckers from Inhood now who are killers. I wonder if I didn't have that family structure how I would have turned out. Cube took his lumps along with everybody else, but sometimes it got much worse. On June 29th, 1981, when Cube was 12, his half-sister Beverly Jean Brown, Jose's daughter from a previous relationship, was slain by her husband in a botched murder-suicide. Beverly was 22, beautiful, and in the prime of life. She and her husband Carl Clifford Brown had been married for less than 2 years. According to a Los Angeles Times report, following a domestic dispute, Brown took Beverly hostage inside of their South Central home on West 53rd Street. Officers who surrounded the house said they heard muffled shots, but continued trying to contact Brown by loudspeaker and telephone. A special weapons and tactics team entered the house after midnight to find Brown wounded and his wife dead. Brown himself died on July 27, 1981, less than a month later. He was a wannabe cop, Cube said. He started out for the LAPD and didn't make it, then went into this depression. Brown was an Air Force sergeant during the final year of the Vietnam War, and then for 3 more years afterward. According to public records, he and Beverly left behind a young son, only a year and a half old. In 1970, a judge ruled that the Los Angeles Unified School District was guilty of segregation and ordered it to fix the problem. In the early 80s, Cube was enrolled in the desegregation busing program and sent to the San Fernando Valley, starting with junior high. His neighborhood schools were problematic. The nearest high school, Washington Preparatory, was a Crip stronghold. William Howard Taft High School, by contrast, was a distant, almost inconceivable place with eucalyptus trees and retro-futuristic architecture. Boasting a mammoth outdoor sports complex, it borders multi-million dollar homes, but has also suffered shootings over the years. Sir Jinx briefly went there as well and described it as a celebrity school for rich kids who pulled up in Porsches. It counts Justine Bateman, Lisa Kudrow, and members of House of Pain as alumni. Cube was a good student who got A's and B's. He played fullback on the football team, along with his friend T-Bone, a tailback. But music was his real focus. He and Sir Jinx formed a group along with their friends Daryl Johnson, known as KD, for Kid Disaster, and Barry Sevier. Sevier was dating Cube's sister Patricia. Older with a car, he could drive them to a studio to lay down professional-sounding tracks. They called themselves the Stereo Crew. It was a way to unify themselves not as gangbangers, but as entertainers. KD said that Cube's first rapping name was Purple Ice, paying homage to both Ice-T and Prince. Their tracks were unpolished. Sevier, now a Sacramento-based parole agent, shared with me 3 very rare Stereo Crew songs from the early 80s. They sound so dated, he warned, and indeed they have the clunky drum machines, robotic vocals, and simple scratching common in early LA hip-hop,
not to mention some bizarre squealing guitar solos. Bust It Up is nearly 6.5 minutes long. Cube is introduced by the other group members. The ice is frozen. The cube is fire. You will drop as he gets higher. But Cube seemed to know what he was doing from the jump and comes out swinging on a track called To Reach the Top. I never use a gun or a knife, and I'll be at the top for the rest of my life. He raps quickly and cleanly in his high prepubescent voice. Even more compelling is the anti-violence anthem Gangs, which castigates hooligans for robbing old ladies and for not snitching on shooters. Cube's verse is the highlight. In 45 seconds flat, he spins a tragic tale about a 44-toting gang member whose civilian friend is gunned down in a drive-by. The gangster responds by killing the perpetrators and is sentenced to the electric chair. It's a classic Cube morality tale, somewhat mirroring his role in the film Boys in the Hood. When you're a teenager, strong convictions come and go. Still, considering the explosive streetwise material they'd soon produce as N.W.A., it's striking that Cube and Dre were disparaging gangs in some of their earliest recordings. Ice Cube and Dr. Dre linked up after they happened to find themselves living on the same street. Sir Jinx's uncle, Curtis Crayon, was Dr. Dre's stepfather. Dre and his mother Verna would often squabble. She wanted him either in school or working, and low-paid DJ gigs didn't qualify. She kicked him out, and so he moved into his younger cousin Sir Jinx's house. Cube and his buddies in Stereo Crew were thrilled to have an emerging star on their block, considering world-class Wrecking Crew's song, Surgery, was building Dr. Dre's name locally. The Stereo Crew members wanted desperately to work with him, but initially, Dre wasn't too keen on this rowdy little group. Man, I don't want to fuck with them, he said. That's my cousin. He's getting on my nerves. Eventually, Dre gave in and agreed to watch Stereo Crew perform in the garage. He was impressed, especially with Cube, whose talent was undeniable even at age 15. Dre and Cube quickly became tight, seeing rap shows, cruising down Crenshaw, hitting the roller coasters at Magic Mountain, or just picking up girls. Despite their age difference, Dre is more than 4 years older. They had plenty in common, even beyond music. They were both interested in architectural drafting, hated gangs, and, on a deeper level, had experienced the death of a sibling. I used to ditch school and run around the corner. He picked me up, Cube said. I roll with him the whole day hanging. Even today when they're together, Cube sometimes seems like Dre's little brother. Around this time, the radio station K-Day sponsored a rap competition called Best Rapper in the West, with the winner to receive a record deal. Performing in front of judges, Stereo Crew's rhymes killed the competition in the early rounds. But in the finals, held at the Hollywood Palladium, they were foiled by a technical glitch. The DJ queued up their cassette at the wrong spot. Cube got pissed and went over to the DJ and said, "What are you doing? You fucking our show up." Sevier remembered, which probably poisoned the well with the judges. They won second place. Fortunately, the group already had a label connection, Alonzo Williams, whom they'd gotten to know through Dre. Lonzo helped them get a one-song deal with Epic Records, and he and Dre co-produced the track called She's a Skag, which came out in 1986. Though largely forgettable, the song has some funny lines. Cube ridicules the object of his desire, the skag, a.k.a. a skanky girl, because she refuses his advances. I said, I'm Ice Cube from the Stereo Crew, he raps. She looked at her friend and they both said, who? Clientele left World Class Wrecking Crew before their 1986 album Wrapped in Romance, at which time Barry Sevier took his place. He called himself Master B, but Dr. Dre thought, Shakespeare, the poet of love, was a swankier name for a member of their cast of heartthrobs. The remaining Stereo Crew members rechristened themselves CIA. At first, it stood for Criminals in Action,
but they later softened it to Crew in Action. They put out a 3-track album on Alonzo Williams' label in 1987. Their Beastie Boys influence was particularly strong. Illegal clearly emulates License to Ill. They also did parody raps of popular records, turning Run-DMC's My Adidas into My Penis and the Pee-wee Herman into the VD Sermon, the latter a humorous tale of sexually transmitted disease that became a crowd favorite. In the period directly before gangster rap, parody raps were all the rage. Compton artist Toddy T turned Houdini's The Freaks Come Out at Night into The Clucks Come Out at Night, clucks being crackheads, of course. His hit song, Batteram, served as social commentary on Daryl Gates' preferred urban warfare tool, but it was also a play on rapper Sean Brown's Rappin' Duke, itself a sort of hip-hop parody that imagined John Wayne rapping. Notorious B.I.G. references it in Juicy. Remember Rappin' Duke? Da-ha, da-ha? Any radio jock worth his salt made funny versions of radio hits. K-Day Morning Show DJ Russ Parr's group, Bobby Jimmy, and the Critters turned Timex Social Club's Rumors, Look at all these rumors surrounding me every day, into Roaches, Look at all these roaches around me every day. The parody craze was surely propelled by the success of Weird Al Yankovic, who debuted in 1983 with songs like I Love Rocky Road and Another One Rides the Bus. Yankovic, after all, grew up in Linwood, which borders Compton to the north. It was a kinder, gentler time for hip-hop on the West Coast, and Ice Cube was as goofy as everyone else. That is, until he flipped the script. Skateland. Roller rinks have long been critical incubators of inner-city music culture. They offer not just good, clean fun and a sugar buzz for knobby-kneed kids, but serve as starter nightclubs for coeds too young to drink. Miami-based DJs, including Southern rap progenitor Luke Campbell, known for his work with 2 Live Crew, spun records for teens at roller rinks in the 80s. 3-6 Mafia got down at a Memphis rink called Crystal Palace, and rapper Nelly and his group, the Saint Lunatics, first recorded at one called Saints. The reality-inspired coming-of-age film, ATL, features rapper T.I. rolling at Atlanta rink Cascade. 2 skate parks were critical to 1980s Los Angeles hip-hop. The first, Mid-City's World on Wheels, was populated by Crips. The carpet was stained with candy and soda, and images of roller skates with wings graced the walls. As for the hardwood, it glistened. Jerry Curl was popular, and it got so hot in here that by the end of the night, the floors would be wet, said Greg Mack, the K-Day programmer. At World on Wheels, his Mixmasters DJ crew spun records for live broadcast, transmitting using a specially rigged phone line connection. Compton's answer was Skateland USA, a cavernous spot that could hold up to 2,000 kids for parties or concerts. Skateland was Compton's first roller rink, opening in 1984 after a father-son real estate development team took over a 40,000-square-foot bowling alley that had been burned, stripped of its copper wiring and plumbing, and left with holes in its roof. The smell of mold was so thick, you could cut it with a knife, said owner Craig Schweisinger. He purchased the property dirt cheap with his father. The younger Schweisinger eventually earned the nickname Craziest White Man in Compton, at least partly owing to the fact that Skateland was housed near West Piru Street, smack dab in the center of Blood Stomping Ground. Events were awash in a sea of red pants and hats. You would rarely see people wearing blue. There was one way in and one way out, remembered Sir Jinx. When you come out, the Bloods lined up, and if they didn't like the way you looked, they would beat the shit out of you. Schweisinger and his father nonetheless had an altruistic vision for the local kids. They restored the facility, installing a 17,000-square-foot hard maple floor. Once it opened,
Skateland attendees had to pass through a pair of metal detectors, which kept the guns out, though they still caught kids with box cutters, razor knives, and surgical scissors, Schweisinger said. For a particularly bananas Eric B. concert, they crammed in 2,600 people, arming a pair of security guards with Uzis. This drew rebuke from the fire and police departments. The latter sent a helicopter and canines. Dre performed with world-class Wrecking Crew at the roller rink's grand opening in 1984, and he became a regular there, playing dominoes with DJ Yella and Eric Wright after hours in the snack bar. They worked on their lyrics and practiced in the DJ booth, with Schweisinger warning them not to spill their E&J Brandy and Pepsi cocktails on the mixing board. Dr. Dre and Ice Cube also played an early show at Skateland together, with the former warning the latter that its attendees wouldn't tolerate mediocrity.
I would tell him that with this crowd, you better get up and rock, because if you didn't, they'd throw these full cups at your ass, Dr. Dre said.
They performed dirty parody songs, turning Salt and Pepper's I'll Take Your Man into I'll Fuck Your Friend. Dre scratched while Cube rapped, including an early version of Gangsta Gangsta.
It was a rough crowd, Cube said. I wasn't sure what we had created was going to work.
Despite their trepidation, Skateland loved their act and were riding on every punchline, he added. The Wrecking Crew enlisted Cube to help them write tracks, including Cabbage Patch, which harvested a national dance craze referencing the pudgy-faced dolls. But by 1986, Cube, now 17, and Dre, 21, were tiring of novelty songs. Their talents were quickly outstripping their groups. Chapter 4. OG. Though he's known today as a gritty West Coast rap pioneer, before he was Ice-T, Tracy Marrow was raised in the well-to-do New Jersey suburb of Summit. In the span of 4 years, both Marrow's parents died of heart attacks, and so during junior high at the dawn of the 70s, he was sent to live with his dad's sister in View Park, a middle-class part of South Central. But he attended the Combustible Crenshaw High School, which in the early days of gangbanging featured both the Hoover Crips and their rivals in red called the Brims, who were later enveloped into the Bloods. The Crips kept their rag in the left pocket. The Crips pierced their left ear. The Brims did everything in the right, like a mirror image, Ice-T wrote in his memoir, Ice. But before long, members of other gangs started transferring, and soon anyone who attended Crenshaw, whether or not they were even in a gang, was assumed to represent the Crips, and thus eligible for beatdowns from rivals. Ice-T said West Side Crips leader Stanley Tookie Williams sometimes dropped by Crenshaw with his equally muscle-bound comrade, Jamel Barnes.
Most days, they dressed identically in farmer overalls with the bib down, showing off their bare chests, shoulders, and arms, Ice-T wrote, adding that at house parties, they were trailed by young Crips who rubbed baby oil on their muscles to impress the girls.
Ice-T never formally joined the Crips, but hung around with members he got to know through his girlfriend, who lived in a Hoover Crip neighborhood. Like so many others, he got caught up in gang's primary appeal. Affection.
My aunt never said she loved me, he wrote. My mother and father were never big on that word. You get to Crenshaw, and you got a male friend saying, "Cuz, ain't nothing never finna happen to you, homie. You safe, cuz. I love you."
At age 17, he moved out of his aunt's home. She agreed to give him the $250 monthly Social Security check she'd been receiving on his behalf, which gave him enough for a cheap apartment and cans of Chef Boyardee. Before graduating, he got his 10th grade girlfriend pregnant, and he decided to join the Army, where he spent 4 years serving in Hawaii and becoming an M60 gunner. Upon his release, he returned to crime, stealing jewelry, Rolexes, Gucci bags, as well as Pontiacs in which to complete such licks. As his partner started getting serious prison time, his interest in hip-hop began paying off. He'd already penned numerous Crip rhymes, tales of intimidation and triumph, performed aloud in front of friends like poems,
rather than being set to music.
He said, "Fuck a Crip nigga. This is Brim." So we pulled out the Roscoe. Roscoe said, "Crack." I looked again. The nigga was shooting back.
The pimp turned best-selling writer Iceberg Slim inspired Ice-T's stage name. He and his crew would show up at clubs and buy the mic, giving the DJ $500 so he could rap all night. After being discovered in 1983 while rapping to impress girls at a beauty parlor called Good Fred, where he got his perm, he agreed to make a single called The Coldest Rap, spitting all the rhymes he knew at the time. It paid about $250, sold well locally, and enchanted the hip denizens of MacArthur Park Underground Club Radio. There, DJs like The Glove and Egyptian Lover and pop lockers like Lil Coco and Boogaloo Shrimp held sway. The spot was the height of trendiness. You couldn't buy booze but could bring your own in, and it hosted the Cold Crush Brothers and even Madonna.
Madonna drew us up on stage into her show, was trying to undress us and shit, the Glove said.
The white kids at the radio knew every word of The Coldest Rap by the time Ice-T performed there. He became the club's house MC, pulling up each weekend in his criminally funded Porsche and appearing in 1984's breakdance exploitation film, Breakin', which was inspired by the venue. In the rather corny film, the Mary Lou Retton-esque lead teams up with street toughs outfitted in studded belts, chains, and spiked wristbands. Following Breakin', the club moved to a different venue downtown and became known as Radiotron. Another good vibe spot was Leimert Park's iFresh, a rap workshop partly funded by a state grant. Running from 1984 to 1989, it allowed young MCs to hone their crafts, including South Central rapper Yo-Yo, whose high school English teacher turned her onto the program and who would go on to record with Ice Cube.
She was really good on her feet, bubbly and really creative right at the tip of her fingers, said iFresh organizer Ben Caldwell.
Not encouraged, however, was Eazy-E, who refused to capitulate to Caldwell's demands to jettison his misogynist lyrics. iFresh later morphed into the famed weekly open mic session held at the nearby Good Life Cafe, which spawned the Project Blowed sessions. Before things got gangsta, iFresh and Radio characterized an optimistic era in Los Angeles when racially and socioeconomically mixed groups of kids got down together. Even New York's king hip-hop impresario Afrika Bambaataa was impressed with the L.A. scene.
It brought together punk rockers, new wavers, hip-hoppers, he said. You could hear funk, reggae, all up in one club. It was like George Clinton said, one nation under a groove.
As for Ice-T, by now he'd developed something of an identity crisis. In the early 80s, he wore then-fashionable tight leather get-ups, spikes, and biker gloves, patterned after New York artists like Melly Mel from the Furious Five. His early songs weren't very tough. But one day, while he and his friend Randy Mack were jamming to the Beastie Boys song Hold It Now, Hit It, Mack made a bold suggestion.
Ice-T should abandon the costume and rap about the real-life details of his recently cast-off criminal lifestyle.
The resulting landmark 1986 song, Six in the Morning, embraced what was happening on the streets of South Central. Named for the LAPD's early hours battering ram raids, the song's protagonist flees the police, beats women, and mows down adversaries. It soon became a local hit. Gangster Boogie. The poet and spoken word performer Gil Scott-Heron, best known for The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, was undoubtedly influential on early hip-hop, as were politically minded spoken word groups like The Last Poets and The Watts Prophets. But much of early rap was bawdy entertainment, influenced by the pimpadelic black comedy tradition, which included Rudy Ray Moore's dirty joke-telling character, Dolomite,
as well as the proudly scatological comedian and musician Blowfly. You can also see the influence of traditional African-American arts like the insult game, the dozens, and toasting, which features braggadocio.